Okay. Again, I've got skulls for if anybody forgot to bring the skull. Did you forget or you don't have one? No. You're quite the negotiator, aren't you? You're not desperate yet. Anybody else? Everybody's good? It has to be a sharer. I can't hand them out, so. You guys have got one. You guys have got one. You guys don't have one. Did you get one? Here, I'll put it kind of here so all you guys can see it. Okay. If you take the top off the skull, please, and look inside, you should see, what's that? It comes up, yep. You should note something that actually, if you haven't done it yet, it's going to be a bit tough. The first time's the hardest. No, come on, come on. Wiggle. You got it. Don't break a nail. Oh, wait, mind you, you got no nails to break anywhere. This one's a tight one. It's because you got a tape. Kind of hard to separate when it's taped. There we go. In there. Okay. Oops. There's your tape. Wherever that belongs. Okay. So, if you look inside, a lot of implicit bias going around here that men can do it and ladies can't, right? So, a lot of implicit bias going on that everybody assumes the man has to do it, right? Oh, you didn't hear that part? No, that, I say that part first. Actually, I used to teach the Professionalism 2 class, and I used to do a whole section on implicit bias, the biases that we all carry that we don't even realize we have. What's that? We all do it. It's very, yeah, I used to have you answer questions and stuff and be shocking to yourself where you think your ideas come from actually aren't your ideas at all. It's your parents, your experiences, your teachers. Yeah. Your religion or whatever. What's that? No, it's just you say to yourself, you know, I believe in this. Well, you didn't believe in it. You were taught to believe in it. So how do you change that if it's a negative belief? Or how do you know if you have an implicit bias? Okay, so you've all got your tops of your heads off. Look down into the skull, please, not the top of the cranium. And you should note a particular pattern there, something that almost looks exactly like a butterfly. Correct. You all see it? Yes. That butterfly configuration is the sphenoid. So that's its own bone, and it does, remember the pterion, right? Part of the pterion was the sphenoid. So the sphenoid does have a minor exposure on both lateral aspects of the skull, both left and right, and it is one large bone that makes up the base of the skull. And because it goes all the way across to both sides, it attaches to 8 different bones. Okay? So frontal, parietal, temporal, occipital, vomer, which is in the back of the nose, zygomatic, palatine, and ethmoid. Right? So because it's down in there, it connects or articulates with a fair number of facial and cranial bones both, okay? So, you can see it here in that, I guess you call that purple maybe? Yeah, purple. You can see it from underneath, and I had you looking at it from up above, and you can somewhat make it out underneath if you kind of flip it over. It's made up of a body and greater and lesser wings. So when early anatomists saw it, they felt it looked like a butterfly or something the same. So therefore, those wings that come out the sides, they said they called them wings because of the configuration. The lesser wings are the anterior wings. So orient yourself to your skull, which is anterior, which is posterior, obviously, where the orbits are and the nasal bone and so forth. That is where it's going to be anterior. So the lesser wings are anterior, and the greater wings are posterior. The body lies between the greater wings. So sort of zero in on yourself looking at it, right? The lesser wings are more anterior, the greater wings behind that, and the body lies between the greater wings posteriorly, okay? Think of the wings come out sort of anteriorly. The superior surface is shaped like a saddle. Can you see that in there? So there's a bit of a indentation. It looks like a saddle, right? Now, did anybody know who invented the saddle? And it weren't cowboys in America. The Turks, the Turkish. So when, again, anatomists looked at this bone, they said it looked like a Turkish saddle for a horse from when saddles were first invented. Initial saddles were actually made of wood. They weren't made of leather like we see now. So hence the name then, Sella Turcica, which basically direct Latin to English is Turkish saddle. Okay, so that's called the Sella Turcica, that indented sort of piece. Within the Sella Turcica, we see a fossa. Now, everybody wondered why I wanted you to know all those terms, and I said they would start coming back quite a bit. So there's a fossa. So you'll see there's a sort of a deep indentation. Does everybody remember what the definition is for a fossa? Yes. Yep. Right. Yes, correct. So you can see the configuration. It looks like on the body, it looks like these two pieces are coming up from this indentation, yes? And again, looking like a saddle. Within that fossa created by the body, and these other parts we're going to talk about in a moment, it houses a very, very important part of the neural endocrine system, so an association to the brain and to the endocrine system, called the pituitary gland. Now, the pituitary gland actually sits within that fossa, highly protected. And the reason there's a hole at the top, if you look, there's a, you know, you can almost put your finger down in the hole in the top of the Sella Turcica, is because the pituitary gland actually has a stalk that attaches to the underside of the brain. And if you were to look at it, it looks like a stalk with a couple of grapes. Small, mind you, but it's a stalk that comes out of the neural tissue and these two grapes. Just to kind of jump ahead, again, next semester, but this relationship between the nervous system and the endocrine system, it's a pituitary gland that produces growth hormones, starts you on the road to puberty when things start to change when you're a child moving towards puberty and then adulthood. So it's a very, very integral part of your normal physiology. Actually, my brother's partner's daughter-in-law, everybody follow that? Okay. My brother's partner's daughter-in-law, okay. So she, about a year ago, she'd had a couple of children. She was a year past having a child, or maybe even 2 years past having a child. She suddenly started lactating and having very odd menstrual cycles and so on and so forth, and they discovered she had a pituitary tumor. So the tumor on the pituitary then influences the pituitary to not release or release hormones. Everybody remembers Andre the Giant? Right, probably more from Princess Bride than from WWF, right? I remember from wrestling. You guys all remember from Princess Bride. He had a condition called acromegaly. And what happened was he had a pituitary tumor, and his pituitary gland actually oversecreted growth hormone. And that's why he became as large as he did. But what happened was, at a certain age, his growth plates closed. So he could no longer get taller. And with the condition acromegaly, when growth plates close, bones can't get any longer, so they get wider. Hence why his cheeks were wide apart. He had a broad nose. His hands, if you looked at them, his fingers are said to be spatulated. They were really thick and wide fingers rather than longer fingers and so forth. So just a little side thing. So Sella Turcica, and the Sella Turcica forms this fossa known as the hypophyseal fossa, which contains the pituitary gland. The posterior aspect of the hypophyseal fossa, so now you're looking at it, and then there's no pituitary gland in there, right? Okay, but you can get an idea where it was. With it removed, the posterior aspect of this fossa is called the dorsum cellae. Dorsum means back, right? So it's the lower part, so it's just saying the lower part of the saddle, correct, right? Lower part of the saddle, okay? So that's the dorsum cellae. Now, projecting superiorly from this fossa are four little sort of crowns or horns. You see that? Right? Two anterior and two posterior. Okay? They are known as the anterior and posterior clinoid processes. Obviously, the anterior ones would be the anterior clinoid process, and the posterior would be the posterior clinoid process. The way to think about it is, the dorsum cellae, the hypophyseal fossa, and the anterior posterior clinoid processes house the pituitary gland. So you have the stalk that comes down with these two grapes. So you have this cella turcica and the dorsum cellae, which is sort of the floor that the grapes sit in. And then you have these two anterior and posterior clinoid processes that come over the top of the two grapes, if you want to call it that. But the space at the top is what allows the stalk to come from the brain down into that area where the pituitary gland is. Okay? Any questions on that? Right. The floor of the cella turcica, believe it or not, is the roof of the paranasal sinuses. So on occasion, they will do surgery to access the pituitary gland by dislocating the jaw and going up through the roof of the mouth to get to the base of the dorsum cellae to access the pituitary gland. Not done very often, but occasionally it is done. That's sort of how close it is. So literally, think of where your nose is, and that roof of that paranasal area, just above it is the dorsum cellae and the pituitary gland. Okay? Yes. Those are your clinoid processes. That's your posterior. Now, you're flat there. If you were to look at a real one, actually, the white ones, I think, have pretty good ones, right? They're a little more, you know, a little more pokey. This one's actually falling apart, unfortunately. It's not as good as it used to be. Unfortunately, the real ones get brittle and they break, so it doesn't look as good. But you get the idea, right? You've got the two anteriorly clinoid processes and the two posteriorly. So we can see them here. Here is your greater wings here in this pinky thing. This is your lesser wing here in green. The body is here. Here's your two anterior clinoid processes, the two posterior clinoid processes. This is the cella turcica, and of course, down deep in there is the dorsum cellae. Okay, any questions on that? You can see it here as well in gold, and it also shows you the exposed lateral aspects of the sphenoid that sits within that temporal area and is part, of course, the pterygium that we talked about last week. Next bone is the posterior aspect is the occipital bone. It forms the base and posterior aspect of the skull. Now, I think I did this last week as well. When you sort of put them together, you know, you can see that lambdoid suture, that sort of inverted V here at the back. And the lower part of the inverted V, of course, this area here, it represents the occipital bone. But like I did last week, that occipital bone comes all the way around to the sphenoid. It forms exactly where my hand is. So it comes all the way around anteriorly from underneath, right? That's all part of the occipital bone. Inferiorly, there is a large hole that's part of the occipital bone known as the foramen magnum. What does that name tell you?
Big hole.
Big hole, right? And it is a big hole, correct? It's the largest foramen in the human body. This is the transition where brain neural tissue starts to move towards becoming spinal cord. We're not there yet. This is where we find what are called the lower centers of the brain. So what you think of as, you know, the traditional brain is the cerebellum, this huge, large thing that fits in the cranium. Well, that neural tissue needs an access to get down into the spinal cord. And as it does, it gets smaller and smaller as it transitions into the spinal cord, but there's certain aspects here of this lower brain such as the medulla oblongata. I'm sure you've heard that term before. So we say that the foramen magnum is where the medulla oblongata exits the cranium, and then it continues as the spinal cord. Okay? On the inferior surface of the occipital bone, on either side of the foramen magnum, are two smooth areas called the occipital condyles. And you can see them there. They sort of come off either side of the foramen magnum. Yep. Flip over. There and there. Okay. So flip it over. You'll see two smooth areas. You've got it. Yep. You guys have got it. Okay. Yep. Sort of anterior part there. This is where, down underneath, anterior to the foramen magnum. Keep going. Anterior to the foramen magnum. Two of them there on either side. You see them? Yep, there and there. That's them. Okay? These are articular condyles where the spine articulates with the skull. So the superior surface of C1, cervical spine, cervical vertebra 1, articulates with the head at these two occipital condyles on either side of the foramen magnum. Okay? And we'll come back to those when we get to the C spine. But everybody understands, sees them there, and that's where your spinal column first articulates with the cranium. All right? So we can see here, this is the foramen magnum, and then somewhat anteriorly here on either side are these large smooth condyles, known as the occipital condyles, again, to articulate with C1. On the median plane, just superior to the foramen magnum, is a knob-like projection called the external occipital protuberance. Okay, so the external occipital protuberance is right here. Have you guys palpated this yet in class? All right, so if you just reach around yourself and come along the occipital bone till you get to the midline, you might find something that feels like a little bit like a frozen pea pointing back at you. Some of you will have a significant one, and some of you will maybe struggle to find one. Anybody here got a good-sized one? Look, a little bump there, yes? Okay. Almost feels like a little tiny frozen pea, yes? Okay. So this is a very important landmark for us as massage therapists, because there are occipital lines that come off this area, which is major attachment points for muscles called suboccipital muscles, one of my favorite groups, because these suboccipital muscles, unfortunately, are the cause of many a headache and blurry vision and tinnitus in the ears and all sorts of things. They're nasty, little tiny muscles, but they can cause a lot of problems. So I used to work a lot in there. But this is your landmark of where you then work out of. So the external occipital protuberance, on the very point of that IEP is another sort of protuberance on top, even smaller than the P, and that is known as the inion. Okay? So you have the external occipital protuberance, the IOP, sort of the larger one, and then on the tip of that is this inion. So we can see here, we've got, obviously we can't palpate down here, right? It's too difficult, so we can see here in this model where, see that bump right there? That's it. That's the external occipital protuberance right here. And then on top of it, the very point of it, is the inion, right? So on your models, you'll see it sort of right there. I don't know what it's like on the, yep, that's it right there. Okay. It's that, on the models that you bought from the bookstore, it looks like an inverted V that comes together and there's a bit of a lump there. Hmm? You lost a tooth? Already? I'm kidding. No, that one's supposed to come out. It's okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right here.
Yeah.
Okay, you got yours? That's it. Yep. Correct. Yes. So the larger part is the EOP, and then on top of that is the inion. Like sort of on the very biggest point, that would be the inion. Okay, but you can see when you palpate it, it's quite significant. Some of you will have a fairly significant one. Some of you will have a very, very small one. Depends on the individual. Okay? You'll be palpating this in lab, guarantee it. Michelle will be so happy I'm ahead of lab because usually I'm behind and she's always giving me hell for it. Now, from moving out, if you look at yours, you'll see that there's a couple of lines that move outward from this external occipital protuberance, right? There's, you know, a couple of lines above and there's some lines below. So we can see here, right, we've got the superior nuchal line here that's right at the external occipital protuberance. So coming off the external occipital protuberance are these two superior nuchal lines. And then below that are two other lines that do the same thing, come off the midline. And this is the inferior nuchal line. So we have the superior nuchal line coming right off the external occipital protuberance. And then below that, we have two more lines, the inferior occipital line that comes off below and, again, heads out laterally to both sides, okay? The superior nuchal line, which represents the superior limit of the neck, extends laterally on each side from the protuberance. And you can see on this model here, now for those who don't know, when we look at some skeletal models, we'll see red and we'll see blue. Okay, now traditionally red is a proximal or just say it's a muscle attachment. Red is one type of muscle attachment, blue is another. So remember we had the fixed muscle was called the origin and the insertion. Right, so in traditional models, blue represented, and I might get this backwards, so I apologize. I believe blue represents insertion and red represents origin, okay? But it doesn't matter for us. At this point, but you can see all these lines in this area. There's a lot of different muscles in this suboccipital area that, again, I used to like playing around in because it really helps people who would have chronic headaches and those migraines, even migrainous type headaches, those sorts of things. So you can see here that between the superior nuchal line, which represents this thin red one right here, that represents the superior nuchal line, and then below that would be your inferior nuchal line, and you can see the muscles that are here. How far can we palpate? Just think of yourself, you know, try to get in and move towards your underside to that foramen magnum. We can't go too far, right? We can only go to about here, and that's about it. And then everything that's deeper is not accessible for our perspective, okay? I know, I took it the whole time, and you couldn't look at it. Just to get for sitting at the front. Okay, so a significant number of muscles find attachment to the superior nuchal line. Inferior to the superior nuchal line is the inferior nuchal line, which again is another area of muscle attachment. And we can see here in the diagram, here we've got rectus capitis posterior minor that's here. We've got semispinalis capitis here, occipitalis here, sternomastoid here, splenius capitis there, superior obliquus capitis here, rectus capitis posterior minor there, and so forth. Right, so we're going to know all those coming up, okay? But just get a sense, there's a lot of musculature in this area, and because of that, and because of our chronic bad posture, these muscles tend to get overworked and cause lots of issues. Remember, chronic bad posture can equal trigger points, right? So you're going to find lots of trigger points in here for sure. We can see it here in this, whatever color that is. You can see how it comes around underneath. There's the foramen magnum there. And then, of course, we have the occipital condyles here and here. This is the superior nuchal line here and here. Inferior nuchal line moving out both sides here. And, of course, the external occipital protuberance is here with the inion on top. Okay? All right. So that's it for the cranial bones. Now we're going to move to the facial bones. When we look at the development of the facial bones, the calvaria of the newborn infant is large compared to a relatively small facial skeleton. So when we look at a newborn child, fundamentally their face is very tiny, but their head's not, right? So the majority of growth, when we see the face and skull get larger as the child matures, the majority of growth is in the facial skeleton, not in the cranial skeleton. There is some enlargement, obviously, but nowhere near the same amount. So the face is very underdeveloped at the time of birth, right? So this results from the small size of the jaws and the almost complete absence of the maxilla and other paranasal sinuses in the newborn skull. Remember, due to, for safety reasons, both for the child to survive birth and the mother to survive birth, we actually give birth, humans give birth to a very underdeveloped offspring, right? You know, we're not like horses where the child can come out and suddenly run across the field, right? Which horses can do. We actually give birth to a very underdeveloped offspring that needs time to develop. And of course, you know, anybody who's got had children or has nephews, nieces, that kind of stuff, when you watch how much that head and face change just in the first year, it's quite amazing, right? It really does change. Sinuses, of course, form large spaces in the adult facial skeleton, which gives it that much. Basically, though, the growth of the maxilla, which is the upper jaw bones, growth of the maxilla between the ages of 6 and 12 accounts for the vertical elongation of the child's face. So this is, we tend to get larger this way with some minor here, okay, as the child ages. Yeah, yes, because they're, the face hasn't developed yet. It's still kind of crushed in, and then it's like a pug, right? A reverse pug. Yeah. I have hard times with pugs and that kind of stuff. I think what we've done to them is breeding is awful. So they can't breathe and get nasal infections and all kinds of stuff just so they can have that cute face, supposedly. I don't think it's very cute. Right, so here we've got all, we've talked about the cranial bones, so now the nasal bones. So the first are the facial bones. First is the nasal bone, of which there are two. Basically, this is the bridge of your nose. Okay, this represents the bridge of the nose. It articulates with the frontal bone superiorly, the maxilla inferolaterally, and the ethmoid bone deeper in behind a bone that you can't see. Okay, we'll get to the ethmoid bone shortly. Right, so it sort of represents that bridge of the nose that we all have. We can see it here in the drawing in sort of this pinky color, sort of sitting here on the maxilla here. We can see it on top here forming its articulation with the frontal bone superiorly. And we can see there actually is a suture that runs right down between the two nasal bones. That's why we say we have two. So again, whenever you see a suture-like configuration, that means that both the right and the left nasal bones developed independently of each other inside mum and then eventually came together to form the bridge of the nose, right? The maxilla. So the maxilla is the upper jaw, right? It is the bone that holds the upper teeth if you're looking at your skeleton. And there are two, even though to you it seems like there's only one. You know, you feel around your own face, you know, it feels like there's only one. But again, inside mum in development, they were two separate bones that ossified and matured on their own to come together to form, all right? So the two maxilla are united in the median plane at what is known as the intermaxillary suture to form the maxilla. If you take your tongue and slide it up the midline of the roof of your mouth, you should feel a line, yes? That is a soft tissue line that represents the intermaxillary suture above it, underneath it. Yeah, okay. The suture is also visible in the hard palate where the palatine process of the maxilla unite. So think about that, that line that you feel, soft tissue, above it is the suture, right? And this is where the two maxillae come together and form the hard palate, basically the roof of your mouth, right? Because it's hard bone there, yes? Each maxilla contains a hollow body that contains a large maxillary sinus. Did you know, I know someone in this room knows, that above the upper teeth is actually a huge space? Okay, your roots actually go up into this maxillary sinus above. So you actually have a thin wall of bone that the teeth go into, but then this massive sinus above those teeth. Now, I've looked into getting, an implant done. And they discovered that my bone between where my teeth go in and this intermaxillary sinus is too thin and I can't get an implant. It's not thick enough bone for them to screw the metal part into the bone. But they do, they try, they can use cadaver bone grafts and put bone in and hopefully it takes and so on and so forth. But I don't need that. But you can see just how significant that is. So this whole space above your teeth is actually hollow. And those roots go right into that space. Right here. There should be a bone there. It's been cut away. So those upper teeth, those roots go right up into his face. This is kind of neat because the colors here show how the nerves come down and innervate the teeth and so forth. You can't see it. It hasn't been removed, unfortunately, in your model, but there should be space there, which your model probably hasn't got, okay? So, again, a hollow body that contains a large maxillary sinus. You know, above the teeth, the bone's been cut away, so you can see in. Normally, it would be flat bone here. You wouldn't be able to see in. All right? Two, a zygomatic process that articulates with the zygomatic bone. So, when you look at the cheek, the zygomatic arch is represented by this arch that we see here. Right? And this represents what you think of as your cheekbone. So there is a zygomatic process that articulates with the zygomatic bone, a frontal process that articulates with the frontal and nasal bones, a palatine process that articulates with the other maxilla to form most of the hard palate. So if you were to look here, I mean, this has been cut along that sagittal line. This represents the hard palate here that would be the roof of the mouth. Okay, so if you turn yours upside down, you should actually see. Can you remove your jaws? I don't know if you can or not. Yeah, not really. Okay. But you can get a sense of where that hard palate is, right? Okay. And then alveolar processes that form the sockets for the teeth. So you can see here, there are little spaces in here where all those teeth go in. So those alveolar spaces are where the roots of the teeth go up into to root in. To form what joint? What kind of joint? Yes, who said it? A gomphosis, correct, which is? A synarthrosis? Yes. Yes, this stuff keeps coming back. Okay. Approximately 1 centimeter inferior to the infraorbital margin is the infraorbital foramen, which transmits a nerve and blood vessels. You can see it here. See the little hole there? Okay, that's in the maxilla. That's actually a foramen where blood vessels and nerves exit. You have one right there. See it right there? You know where that is. Right there. Okay, so if you look underneath the orbit, which is the circle where the eyeball would fit in, just underneath it on the base of it, you should see a foramen. Right, you see it? Yep. Nope. Right there. See a little hole? Okay. So now you're going to put your skull down for a minute, and you're going to actually think, look at your skull, think of where that hole is, and you're going to come around just under the orbit of the eye and come down, and you'll be able to palpate this foramen. Just gently about there, just push, and you'll feel a bit of an indentation. You feel a bit of an indentation? If you've got a bit of a sinus issue, this might actually be sore. Painful? Yeah, you might have still got some sinus stuff going on. Did you find it? Do you feel a hole? Right there. Yep. Everybody find it? Through handwork, body work, you can actually, if someone's got a bit of a stuffed up nose, you can do massage in this area and it will actually drain. Yes. Okay. Some of you probably already pushed here if you had a head cold anyways, right? You got that pressure and you would just naturally like, oh, God, this is killing me, right? You actually are pushing on those foramen on this infraorbital foramen. As maxillary teeth are removed, the maxilla can become smaller, thus marked reduction in the height of the lower face. This is why dentists don't like removing teeth and leaving them without being replaced, because basically your face caves in. The bone tissue where the alveolar spaces are, if teeth are removed, it atrophies. It actually just shrinks and starts disappearing. This is why if anybody remembers, you know, great-great-grandparents, maybe they were alive or seeing people on the street back when dental wasn't quite what it is now, you would see people, you know, who got the gums crushed in, because it can get to the point where the bone will atrophy. No, I might be quoting wrong here, but I'm pretty sure the bone atrophies so much they can't even wear a denture because there's nothing to really push it onto. It just actually disappears. Okay. So we can see it here in green. Here's your maxilla here in green. You see how it articulates with the nasal bones here, frontal bone there. Ethmoid back here is that little purple bone inside the orbit. And we can see the two foramen here and here that are palpable. Okay. And remembering, it comes together here at the midline. You can see it here as well with all the other bones removed except for the nasal, and this represents the maxilla. Here is the zygomatic process here that you can see exposed with the zygomatic bone removed, and here we can see the relationship articulation between the maxilla and the zygomatic bone here with the zygomatic bone in place. Okay, so where the maxilla and the zygomatic bone articulate, on the maxilla, this is known as the zygomatic process. Any questions? Hard to see if you can't take your face apart, right? Which is kind of unfortunate. But now the mandible is the lower jaw. So that's the lower part there. Some of you may not have one with the models I handed out, but you do if you had the ones that you got at the bookstore. It's the movable part, that lower part of the jaw. It makes up the lower jaw and is the largest and strongest facial bone. It is U-shaped in the superior view. So I have a real one here. And this one almost fits me perfectly. Okay? I can see some of you guys using these skulls Halloween night, yes? Maybe put some lights in the eyeball saw in the orbit or something. But you can see it's U-shaped in the superior or inferior view. It consists of two parts. It has a vertical part, one on each side, and a horizontal part. The two horizontal parts, which is singular when the bone is mature, this is known as the body. Okay, so the horizontal part is the body, and the two vertical parts are known as the rami for plural or ramus for singular. Okay, so you have the body here, and then you have the two ramus, the two together rami, one on each side, and that is the vertical part. Each ramus ascends vertically from the posterior aspect of the body. In other words, where the vertical part starts is where the body ends. So if you think of, you know, this square ramus, anterior to it right at this point, from this point around to this point where my fingers are, all of that anteriorly would represent the body of the mandible. These two represent the two ramus, or together rami, of the mandible. Okay? Horizontal parts, vertical part. All right? Now, there are some things on the top of the ramus that you can see. Right? There is one anteriorly and another process posteriorly. Before I name them, what I want you to understand is the posterior processes that articulate, and the anterior process is for attachment of tendons and ligaments. Okay? So the posterior aspect is articulation, the anterior is for attachment. The posterior process is called the condylar process. The articulating one is called the condylar process. Okay? And the anterior one is known as the coronoid process. So this is the condylar process, and this is the coronoid process. Any questions? So we can see here is the body. Here is the ramus with the condylar process posteriorly, right? And the coronoid process anteriorly. And if you look at it, the condylar process is quite thick and robust, whereas the coronoid process is very thin, almost blade-like. Now, why is it there? You know, why do we have this zygomatic arch, and then we have this thin coronoid process? If you open and close the mouth, and now it's not great on this one, but if I attach it to the real one, you can see that in reality, that coronoid process actually tucks right up behind, right up behind that zygomatic arch, yes? You can see it come underneath. So that's the reason why you have that zygomatic arch, is to allow for that coronoid process to be able to move freely when the mouth is elevating and depressing. Yes? Okay? All right. The condylar process is separated from the coronoid process by the mandibular notch. So you'll note here that the condylar process is posterior, the coronoid process is anterior, but there's a big deep drop here, right? This is known as the mandibular notch. So you have the condylar process posteriorly, the coronoid process anteriorly, and between the two is the notch. Okay? And this forms the concave superior border. Now, where the rami and the body meet, okay, this is known as the angle of the mandible. And there's lots of variation of this angle. If we look at each other's jaws, just particularly, we can see, you know, it's the shape of the jaw. There's a significant variation, amount of variation in each individual's jaw configuration. So this part where the meat is known as the angle, and it can really vary depending on the individual and how their genetic makeup is. Inferior to the second premolar on either side is another foramen. So if you look down at the teeth on either side, you'll see another foramen on either side. This is known as the mental foramen. The chin anatomically is actually called the mental region. Please don't ask me why, because I don't have an answer for you. I can't find it either. Okay, so this chin area is known as the mental region, and you have the mental foramen on either side, and this too is palpable, just like it was infraorbitally. So just take your finger and roll around that either side, and you'll find a hole there. Don't press too hard. There's a significant nerve there. If you hit it, you'll get a little zinger that kind of goes out a little bit. And again, when I put my hands where my hands are, or my foramen are, again, because of the variation of the mandible with each individual, it's either going to be farther out or closer to, depending on each of you, as to where you might find it. Okay. Pretty close, I would think. Maybe. Yeah. Right. You also have a supraorbital foramen right here as well. That's the one where you get in there if someone's got a head cold. All right, so you have the either side of the mandible is this mental foramen. The two halves of the mandible begin to fuse during the first year and are fused by the end of second year of outside mum. Okay, so they're not completely fused at birth, but over the next 2 years, they'll completely solidify and make what you'll see as a solid mandible. At the point where the two halves ossify is called the mental protuberance, which of course represents the chin. This bone articulates with the temporal bone superiorly at the condylar process to form the temporomandibular joint, also known as the TMJ, of which how many people here have problems with their TMJ? Yeah, it's a pandemic in our society right now. I was talking to someone about people wearing splints, and everybody should almost wear a splint now. It's that joint that gets all chewed up if you grind your teeth. How many people here are grinders? Yeah, how many people here are clenchers? Yeah, see? Lots, right? How many people here wear a splint? Look at that, another hand went up. Get a splint! Trust me, I'm an old guy. I didn't wear a splint forever. I have more bridges and crowns and root canals. Why? Because I didn't wear a splint and I ground my teeth down and they started falling apart. So if you clench or you grind, get a splint. Night guards now? Oh, okay. Get a guard, whatever it's called. Get one, it'll save you, trust me. Thousands of dollars when you get to be my age, it will save you. Okay, so we can see here, we've got the mental foramen here. Mental protuberance down here, the chin. We have the body here, the ramus here, with the mandibular angle here. We have the coronoid process anteriorly, the mandibular notch in the middle, and then the condylar process posteriorly, where it is the condylar process, articulates with the temporal bone to form the temporomandibular joint, which we'll be talking about next today. Okay? The next bone is the zygomatic bone. Now, the zygomatic bone is forms basically what we think of as the prominence of the cheeks, this area of the cheek. It's formed by the prominences of the cheek, the anterolateral rims, and much of the infraorbital margins of the orbits. So if you look at your model, and you may not be able to see it here, but I've kind of drawn it in, you can see there's a black line here and here and down there. That borders the zygomatic bone. Okay? So here and here and here is the zygomatic bone. So you got a black line. Yeah, more right there. See that line right there?
Oh, yeah.
So here and here and that black line that bordered the zygomatic bone. Okay? Can you see it? See here and here and here, all of this is the zygomatic bone. Okay? Guys, see it here? So here, here, and that line there, this is the zygomatic bone.
Yep, right here.
Yep, we're at the number 9, correct. Guys, see it here? Or do you know where you are? So here, here, and here are the lines. This is the zygomatic bone right here. Okay. Do you remember all this?
Yeah.
Kind of, sort of?
Yeah.
Okay, so here, here, and that line there, this is the zygomatic bone right here. Yep. Okay. You guys already saw it down there? Awesome. So here, here, and that line, that's the zygomatic bone right there.
Okay.
So that front of the cheek right there. Yep. Okay, you guys good? Everybody good? Okay. You can see on the real models, it's so much nicer than on the fake ones. It really is quite obvious when you look at it. Sorry? Could be. Oh yeah, it's me. Yeah, I it's a spelling mistake. Good catch. Okay, there's a spelling mistake. The top one's spelt wrong. Should be ZY. So it's formed by the prominences of the cheeks, the anterolateral rims, and much of the infraorbital margins of the orbit. It articulates with the frontal bone, the maxilla, the sphenoid, and the temporal bones. Note that the temporal process of the zygomatic bone unites with the zygomatic process of the temporal bone to form the zygomatic arch. Like I said that already once before, right? Last week? Okay, again, I'll repeat. The temporal process of the zygomatic bone articulates with the zygomatic process of the temporal bone to form the zygomatic arch.
Does the zygomatic process of the maxilla have anything to do with arch?
No, they don't call it an arch because it doesn't form the zygomatic arch that we saw for the coronoid process fits in. It's more of a, they call it a process, but it's more of a tight fit, so it doesn't really form an arch. So we can see it here. This is the temporal process of the zygomatic bone, and here is the zygomatic process of the temporal bone to form the zygomatic arch. And you can see how the zygomatic bone here does form most of the lateral and inferior lateral aspects of the orbit itself. So if you looked inside the orbit, you would see that there's a bit of a suture in there too that would represent where the zygomatic bone internally goes in to form the inside lateral aspects of the actual orbit. Okay? Palatine bones. This forms the posterior one-third of the hard palate, and the horizontal plate forms the roof of the mouth, but it also forms the floor of the nasal area. Okay, so it forms the roof of the mouth orally, but also forms the floor of the nasal area superiorly. Okay, remembering there's two sides and they grow together. So we can see here the maxilla forms the anterior part of the heart palate, and the palatine bone forms the posterior aspect here. So again, it forms the posterior one-third that we see right here in this kind of pinky color. So maxilla represents the anterior two-thirds, the palatine represents the posterior one-third of that roof of the mouth. Next, it's the lacrimal bone. Everybody here heard of the lacrimal gland? It's a gland that's involved in keeping your eyes moist and crying and that kind of stuff. So we're right. All right. So it forms the medial wall of the orbit. So again, if you look in at the orbit on the medial wall, right, that facing closer to the midline, that is the lacrimal bone. It articulates with the frontal bone, the maxilla, and the thymoid. That should be Y. T-H-Y-M-O-I-D. These are considered to be the smallest facial bones, and you can see them right deeply. Where are we here? Come on, where are you? Lacrimal bone right here. I got to orient myself. Here's the nose. This little purple part right here, and you can see, you can kind of see it here underneath, right? And in this orange, it's been removed, but you can see where it fits in here. So, you know, ultimately, your face is a jigsaw puzzle, right? It's a jigsaw puzzle. It's made up of all these little pieces that all sort of connect and articulate with each other properly, right? And remember, from a developmental point of view, each of these developed and ossified on its own to all come together to form what we think of as the face, as this solid thing. But it is, in fact, actually a jigsaw puzzle. Next is the ethmoid, and this forms the anteromedial floor of the cranium, the roof of the nasal cavity, and part of the nasal septum, and the medial orbital wall. So we can see it right here. And if you look inside your skull, anterior to the sphenoid, you'll see this area right here. It's sort of, it's got this little sort of wing on it with a bunch of little holes. Do you see that? If you look inside towards above the nose, right from on the top, you'll see this little wing with a bunch of little holes in it. Not a wing, but a fin. Sorry, a fin is the appropriate word. Right there. Okay. Everybody see it? See that little fin with the little tiny holes in there? Okay. So, there are a number of sinuses in this bone which contain mucous membranes which help flush the nasal cavity. But there are three parts to this ethmoid bone. The first is called the cribriform plate. Where you see all those little tiny holes, it allows for the access of a cranial nerve to pass through into the mucous membranes on the superior aspect of the nose. And those nerve fibers might be responsible for what? Why would we have direct brain fibers sort of go down into the spaces inside the nose? What's the nose responsible for? Smell, right? So olfactory nerve. So it actually uses those small little holes in this ethmoid bone known as the cribriform plate, and it allows these nerves to come down through the holes of this cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone to infiltrate into the mucous membrane of the superior aspect of the nose, which allows us to smell. And for others who are crazy, but it's also direct access to the brain for certain chemicals that might make you feel good. Cocaine. Fentanyl. Yeah, that's it. Because it's direct access to neural tissue, this is why snorting coke has a direct effect, a very quick effect on the brain, because it's direct access to the neural tissues just through allowing that chemical to come all the way through. Unfortunately, it seems to be the practice of OxyContin back in the day, too. I think I told you guys before. If you get a chance, either on, I think it's on Prime or on Crave, it's either Dope Sick or Painkiller, and on Netflix. It's all on the history of OxyContin and the terrible things it's done to people. And then we have two lateral masses paired in a perpendicular plate. For my purposes, A is what's more important to understand that you need to know, okay? Now, see all these holes? You need to know them. No, not quite. just a few of them. Bit of a challenge, isn't it? We have this facial bony area and this big cranium. Now within there, we have, especially up above, we have a big organ in there called the brain. And if the brain is encased in bone, well, how the heck are we going to get blood to the brain and blood away from the brain? And how are we going to get the messages from the brain out to the body? How do we get that neural tissue out? We do that by having holes or foramen that allow vessels in, allow vessels out, allow lymph in, allow lymph out, and allow nerves mostly out, some in, through only these holes because there's so much bone here. So we can see there are very many of them here. We've talked about the largest one, of course, known as the foramen magnum that we see here. Wherever you see a Roman numeral, that represents a cranial nerve. So these are nerves that exit the brain. And because they exit the brain, they're called a cranial nerve. That nervous tissue that goes down into the spinal cord and exits out to the body through the spine are called spinal nerves. Okay, and we'll get to those later. But for now, just understand that when you see Roman numerals, and I know none of you guys are, who's trained in Roman numerals? Do you take them at school anymore? A few? Yeah, they don't teach it at all anymore. I know. That's a cranial nerve, of which there are 12. And some of them are for sight, some of them are for smell, some of them are for hearing, and so forth. Yeah. No, they're on the left. They're on both sides. So you do have a right and left. That's a good question, actually, because you can have a stroke on one side, and the other side won't be affected. You might do damage to the cranial nerve on the one side. Now, when it comes to cranial nerves, if you have a stroke, the symptoms or the signs will be on the same side as the stroke. If you have a stroke that affects spinal nerves, the symptoms are on the opposite side. But I won't ask a question on that, so don't worry. That's for your neuro class. Yes. Yes. And the names of the holes are on the other side. Those are the ones you need to know. Okay? So you need to know rotundum, ovalate, spinosum, lacerum, jugular, hypoglossal canal, internal acoustic meatus, and the foramen magnum. And you also need to know what passes through them, either in or out. So you need to know that whole chart. So rotundum carries the maxillary nerve, cranial nerve 5, known as the trigeminal nerve, maxillary meaning upper part, right, maxilla. The ovale contains the mandibular nerve, cranial nerve 5, trigeminal. So again, so that means the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5, has branches. It has a mandibular branch, a maxillary branch here to the maxilla, and a mandibular branch down here to the mandible. Okay. The spinosum carries the middle meningeal artery, which is obviously supplying blood to the area of the brain. Lacerum is the internal carotid artery. It is the most medial of all the foramen, and it allows the major blood supply up into the brain through that carotid artery, the internal carotid artery. Jugular, of course, is the exit point for the jugular vein, which is the blood leaving the brain. Hypoglossal canal is for the hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12, which moves the tongue. Okay? If the internal acoustic meatus is part of the external auditory meatus. Right, you know, the ear hole, that's the hole that you can hear. Well, the bony part is known as the internal acoustic meatus, and it houses, of course, cranial nerve 3 for hearing. That makes kind of sense, right? And then, of course, magnum we just talked about, and that, of course, carries the junction of the medulla and the spinal cord, vertebral arteries, which we'll be spending some time on here soon, and then, of course, anterior and posterior spinal arteries as well. Okay? So those ones you need to know. Yes. It is where are we here? It should be somewhere. There it is. Yeah. Now, believe it or not, that's how many there actually are on one side. So imagine, if you will, you're a spinal surgeon, a neurosurgeon. You have to know all these. The other thing is, as well, you know, understanding where all these things go in and come out if someone has a stroke and something gets affected. So there actually is a test for a stroke where you may have the patient sit in front of the physician. They think they have a stroke, and they ask them to stick their tongue out. And what will happen is, if there's paralysis on one time, on one side versus another, when they stick the tongue out, it'll go. It won't be able to stick out straight because one side's paralyzed, so the one that's working properly will pull the tongue to the one side. It's a classic kind of test for anything neurologically that might be going on, amongst many other ones that affect, you know, cranial nerves open and close the eyes are the muscles that control the lids and your tongue, your ability to speak, and all the musculature that occurs here. So strokes, you have aphasia. So people who can talk like this, they can't talk. They can hear and they can interpret what you're saying, but they're spiel. That's how they speak, because the nerves that supply the muscles to the tongue and so forth to speak don't function, so they're unable to form words. Reality as you know it is only your reality because your neurons are speaking to each other. The Buddhists have it right, right? Your reality is the reality you make it. It's quite fascinating when you get into it that certain individuals will have a stroke and they don't know they even have the left side of their body anymore. It doesn't exist to them. Even though they can look at it, it's not theirs. They think it's somebody else's. All right, so landmarks. When we're done, we'll take a break. Anterior landmarks, these are ones to consider when you're palpating and so forth. The forehead, of course, represents the frontal bone. The orbits represent the eyeballs. The zygomatic bones represent the cheeks. The nasal apertures, your nose holes, okay, represent the nasal cavities. Maxilla bones, of course, are the upper teeth. Mandible is the lower teeth. Lateral, the temporal bone contains the external auditory meatus, or your ear holes. And, of course, the one you'll all be using all the time is the mastoid process is contained within the temporal bone. We use that for a lot of landmarking and beginning palpations in the upper cervical region and so forth, okay? Posteriorly, on the occipital bone, we have the superior nuchal line. Again, you'll be palpating this. The inion and the external occipital protuberance, all of these for sure. Any of these you'll be palpating in your lab class this semester, okay? The superior skull, of course, is formed by the frontal bone, posteriorly to the occipital bone, and the only thing there is its very highest point is called the vertex, which is the highest part of the skull. See you guys around 10-2, 10-2 and 5-2, okay?